last time this year. Okay, so now you should know everything about how supercomputers are built up, right? So starting from now, we will take a look at the various supercomputers that have been built. And after we covered those, we will take a look at the supercomputers that might get built in the future. Okay, so the current development that's going on there. So a good list of supercomputers is the top 500 list. Okay, it's available. It's a website, top500.org, and it has first of all lots of news. And it's most famous for the top 500 list, right? And the list is being published twice a year, once in June and once in November. Okay, and it has a quick rundown and then the actual list, right? So where we're at it right now is that we are at 2.4 million cores. And 200 petaflops of performance. Okay, or well, the actual measured performance is one. So this is the theoretical performance, and that's the measured performance with a matrix-matrix multiplication. Okay, and you get some details about the systems. So the current number one system is an IBM Power system with Power9 processors and NVIDIA Volta GPUs. And a InfiniBand network. Okay, so but that's pretty much all there is. Well, a few more details, but that's pretty much all there is to get from those systems in the list. Okay, so let's see how we got there. Okay, so what I want to start with is a quick rundown over the past few systems which were interesting. Okay, so traditionally the top 500 list is dominated by the United States, by the USA, and well, the reason for that is did I mention why supercomputers were built in the first place? Very briefly. I think so. The biggest reason is is that the USA built up the top 500 list, obviously, right? And the reason why they were in need for such systems is they needed to simulate physical effects, okay, and mostly to simulate nuclear bombs, okay, to simulate the fitness of their nuclear nuclear weapons, okay. So I think 1980 or something, there was this treaty that no atomic bomb was to be fused on the planet anymore, right? And however, we still have up to today lots of nuclear warheads, right? So they are lying around there, and what do you do if you are not supposed to blow them up, right? And how do you ensure that they are, first of all, still operational, second of all, safe, right? So they then decided to, well, we could simulate it, right? So there's lots of code has been written to simulate those the fitness for the warheads. Today that's not the only reason why they exist anymore. But that's traditionally what's happened, and you see it. So the supercomputer that was the fastest up until 2001 was located at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. Okay, that's located in the East Bay Area in San Francisco, in California. And at this laboratory, a hydrogen bomb was developed, actually. Okay, the laboratory still exists today. They are now spearheading the whole fusion energy thing. They have the biggest laser in the world, I believe, and they are still in need for lots of computational power. So the Lawrence Livermore National Lab is one big center, and there are other national labs that have big computers as well, like Oak Ridge National Laboratory, Argonne National Laboratory, and Sandia National Laboratory, to name a few, right? And those are all for national security, and it's not very easy to access those, but eventually other labs or compute centers took on the trend as well. And in 2002, the Earth simulator was deployed in Japan. Okay, and the Japanese traditionally also have a very high need for high performance computing, for supercomputers. Well, the Earth simulator, as the name suggests, is trying to simulate the Earth. Okay, and that's also the first system that we want to look at. Okay, so let's take a look at it. So it was 5 times faster than the previous system, than the ASCII-wide system, and of course the United States were shocked, right? So how can it be that other people, other nations can build such machines, right? The United States have Intel, AMD, and whatnot, right? So what happened there? And it actually remained number one until November 2004. And yeah, let's take a look at it. What you have here in this picture is a rendering of the entire building. Okay, so they built a complete building just for the computer. Okay, so it has those steel thingies to harden it. You have shielding by steel plates from electromagnetic waves. You have air conditioning. You have here almost a full floor, which is just for the cabling. You have in the ground floor, you have the air conditioning system, you have the power supply system, and at the bottom you have a seismic isolation system. Okay, so even if there would have been an earthquake in Japan, this building would have lasted, right? And yeah, so this is where the compute nodes and the storage was built. And yeah, and this is how it looks. Okay, so one special power plant just for the machine, okay, the building for the computer system, and then the office building for operation and research, right? That's the scale, right? And that's pretty interesting. So from a high level architecture, it's a MIMD system, right? So a classical cluster computer, so to say. It is able to execute multiple instructions and multiple data. It has 640 processor nodes and takes 6.4 megawatts of power, right? So that's why they needed the separate power plant. What they have on the processors is our special 8 vector processor units. Of course, they have a dedicated building, and as I showed, it's one floor just for the cables. Okay, so why did they need so many cables? So here's another picture with the cabling. I'm not sure if you're able to see it. Quite a few cables, right? And what you see here is a rendering of the compute floor, where you have the compute nodes surrounding the interconnection network, right? You have a huge island just for the interconnection network. And at the border of the circle here are the nodes to store the data that's being computed. Okay. And the special floor for the cables. So Take a guess. Why did they need so many cables? Why did they need an extra floor for the cabling? If you consider the last lecture regarding network topology.
Because they're using the tooling. Because what was the name of the third way of interconnecting tooling? The third way to interconnect. There is a.
The torus.
Torus.
No. Yeah.
So they're connecting in that way, and you have completely many nodes. So I don't know. They're making a 4D, 5D dimension.
Okay.
What you're connecting?
Good guess, but the idea behind the torus is that you don't need that many cables.
So is okay. It the kind of fat tree?
No. It's actually a full crossbar switch. Okay. So that's why they needed so many cables, right? So in each processor node?
It's connected to all nodes.
All nodes, yeah. Yeah. So
then it's an efficient way.
It's very efficient.
But the thing is that we'll say that the previous guys will say that full crossbar is inefficient in somehow because you need too much cables.
Yeah.
They could have done it with tourists. And they will have, they maybe can have the same result.
They decided to build a full crossbar interconnect, okay, because it's the fastest in terms of performance.
Or money. They
have, okay, they have and money. They just have money, right? So they just spend a huge amount of money to build this machine, right?
Why not?
Yeah.
Instead of burning, okay.
No. So, as mentioned, you have 640 processor nodes. Each node has 8 of those vector processors, right? And they are connected via the full crossbar switch, right? Which is pretty intense. Okay.
Expensive.
Expensive, sure. And I think it actually was the last supercomputer that was built with a full crossbar interconnect.
Maybe they don't know about it.
I mean, 640 nodes, that's, I guess, manageable, right? Still quite a bit, but, you know, why not? Okay, so let's look at the processor design, okay? So what you have in the processor is that you, first of all, have a one scalar unit and 8 vector units, okay? The scalar unit is 4-way superscalar, and the vector unit is 5-way superscalar. That means that they can issue 4 instructions at the same time, and here 5 instructions at the same time. What's interesting is that it's only operating at 500 megahertz, right, of clock frequency.
That is quite slow, no? For example, for the OS on the standard today.
Is it?
No. We have now gigahertz.
Sure, but if you look at GPUs, for example, they are clocked at 1.2 or 1.4 gigahertz, for example. And so let's look at it. Where do they get the computational power from? Right, they have 8 vector units, right, and each vector unit has 256 vector element registers, 72 vector registers. And 256 elements in the register, in those registers. That's plenty, right? And you have 8 of those, right? And that's where you get the computational power from, similar to the GPUs.
Because normally in a normal computer, how much vector registers do you have?
For AVX 512, I think it's 32. No. Yeah. And you don't have that many vector units to operate on, right? No. So, and the question then is, the other interesting thing is that you don't have a cache on the vector units, right? You only have the load store buffer. You have the vector registers and where you can then divide, add, multiply, etc. And the scalar unit is then driving those vector units, right? And the reason why you need the scalar unit is obviously not all code can be Canon should be vectorized, right? So you need some scalar unit to actually drive the design, drive the vector units. Okay. Yeah. So it was also a custom built design. Okay. So it was special purpose built just for the supercomputer. Okay. So I'm not sure if there are any other installations with this kind of processor in it. That's also quite interesting. Right. So the interconnect, as mentioned, is a full crossbar network. The advantage is that you really only have one hop between any of those two nodes, right? So you go to the switch and then to the other processor node, right? Which is quite performant in terms of latency, right? You have very low latency, but it's also very expensive, right? So you have those 130 units for the switching, right? And you have 640 nodes, right? That means that you need 83,000 electric cables, which is, impressive. Yeah, and of course, the slide says it's the last number one machine to really use a full crossbar network, right? But the amount of hardware that you need in terms of cable and also in terms of the switching units, right? It's just massive. You have 130 units, right? A third of the actual compute nodes just for the network, right? Which is I don't think in any good relation. Okay. So so much for the Earth simulator. So the next one, top one system was the IBM BlueJeanE L. Okay, it was the fastest system from November 2004. So it took over the place from the Earth simulator. And as you see, it also only operates at a fairly low clock frequency, but it has a huge amount of cores, right? So 65,000 is quite a bit. It has a huge amount of main memory, and it has 280 teraflops of LINPACK performance, okay? That means that LINPACK is the benchmark that's used for the top 500 list, and it's the dense matrix multiplication essentially. Okay, and they had different stages of deployment, and the first installation only had 8 cabinets, okay, and peaked at 36 teraflops, and the system was built with scalability in mind, right? So that means that they could easily add more and more cabinets, okay, and eventually reach the 280 teraflops, okay, and so it's an IBM machine, and they also developed a custom hardware just for this machine. Custom hardware means they designed a custom processor and a custom interconnect. So judging from the scalability of the system, that you could easily add new cabinets to it, what do you think the interconnect network could be?
Maybe a fat tree topology, so you just basically copy the system and then add one bigger switch to connect the two.
Okay. Okay, maybe. Let's see. We'll answer that question later on. So the design goal for the BlueJeanE was really to get a high flops per watt ratio, right? And the whole architecture was designed to get into the into the petaflops range, right? So at 280 teraflops, we are still we still miss a little bit, but the BlueChine L was the first BlueChine machine in a series of developments. So we also had the BlueChine P and the BlueChine Q. The BlueChine Q, unfortunately, was the last BlueChine system. And the goal really is to not require so much cooling in order to operate the system, right? And right. So the network, the primary network is a torus network. Okay, the torus is the most scalable one, I'd say. Okay, and that's the reason why they could easily insert additional cabinets into the system. Okay, and the BlueChine is a tiered architecture. That means that you have one BlueChine chip. Okay, one chip has two cores. Okay, then you assemble two of those chips onto a compute card. Okay, and once you have four cores on a compute card, you put 16 compute cards on a node board, and this is then one node, right? And one node then has 64 cores, and it can be very densely packed into the system, right? And once you have your node card, you can put up one rack, okay, where you put in 32 node boards, where you have 512 compute cards, and per rack you have 2048 cores, okay, and this is how they designed the whole rack. So you have the cool air flowing into the rack from the bottom, and the hot air flowing out at the top, right? So they have this kind of slanted design for their racks. And that way they could easily or they designed a very energy efficient air cooling system. Okay, so the approach that they took for the whole system was the slow computing approach. That means they have a very fast network, but relatively slow processes to improve the application scalability. Okay, so one of the challenges in when programming for those large scale systems is most of the time the network. Okay, so someone said supercomputing is when you turn compute bound problems into bandwidth bound problems. Okay, essentially. So when you have relatively slow processes, that means that the computational power per core isn't that high, right? But if you have a fast enough network, you can scale easily to the entire system. And as mentioned, the entire system has had 64 racks, right? Where you just add one cabinet after the other. And due to this slanted design of one rack, you can also stack them nicely next to each other. Okay. So what's the slow computing approach? Okay. So the question is, what's better? A few fast CPUs or many slow CPUs, right? And the intuitive answer, of course, is few but fast CPUs. And that's essentially also seconded by Amdahl's law. Okay, so who have you heard of Amdahl's law before? Okay, so Amdahl's law is essentially a formula to calculate the speed up of your program. And what you do is you take the time it took to run your problem, to run your application sequentially, and divide it by the time it took when you run it in parallel. Okay, and it builds up a model for those timings, right? And the model is that you have a problem size where you have well, some number n, and you have the number of processes. Okay. Then you have some time which is inherently sequential, right? Which you can't parallelize, which is denoted with the sigma. And then you have the time for the parallelizable calculations, which is phi. And in addition to that, you have the time for the communication per processor. Okay? So far, so good. If you add it together, you get the speed up calculation. Okay? So you have for the serial time, you simply have the sequential portion plus the parallel portion of the code. And for the parallel time, you have the serial portion, right? And then you take the maximum out of the time it takes for the parallelized portion, right? So the parallel region of your code can be divided by the number of processes, right? Obviously. But you still have some communication left, which is not parallelizable, right? So you have to take the maximum out of it. And if we assume that the problem size is fixed, right, we get something like that, when we plot the time, we get something where we speed up the calculation pretty significantly at the beginning, but then it eventually converges to some number, right? So the idea the idea behind Amdahl's law is that it demonstrates that obviously only the parallel portion can affects the speed up of your problem, right? And the serial fraction and the communication eventually kill the performance for large p, right? So if we have so this is just one just some made up numbers essentially, where you have when you have a small problem size and you increase the number of cores, right? You first you get some speed up and eventually the communication time kills your performance. If you increase the problem size, right, you are able to get more scalability, right? Because the parallel, so the assumption is that the parallel region takes up more and more time, right? And that way you can benefit from more processes, right? And if you remember, if you have a fast network, right, then this this term here hopefully gets small enough, so it doesn't affect the potential speed up that you might get. Right, and no. So let's take an example. If we have a three-dimensional stencil code, right, where we have a grid of 1,000 cells, right, and let's assume that per cell update we have six floating point operations, and we need 8 bytes of memory. Okay. And let's assume that we have a 40 gigabit per second InfiniBand network. That means that we can approximately transfer around 4 gigabytes per second. Okay. Then we have a cuboid grid decomposition. Okay. That means if we have our three-dimensional grid. Okay. Okay. Where each side is 1,000. Okay. Then no. I have to improve my drawing skills, obviously. Then we decompose the problem in such a way that we just put those smaller cubes into, so we decompose the entire grid that in such a way that each processor only processes one of those cubes, right? That means that each CPU can update k cells in parallel, right? So where we have, for example, k equals 100 for 1,000 cores, then we require six times k flops, and we have to send six times k times 8 bytes to the neighboring CPUs for the ghost cell communication. Okay, so if we are at the boundary here, right, we have to exchange our data at the boundary in order to calculate the stencil efficiently. Okay, so again, we need to take into account our inherently serial fraction, our parallelizable fraction, and our communication time. Okay. So the question now is, which variant is faster? If we have 1,000 CPUs, where each of the CPUs can take 48 gigaflops, or the second variant where we have faster CPUs but fewer, which are capable of doing more gigaflops per second. Okay. That's what you would guess, right? Because you don't run into the problem of Amdahl's law, right?
184 is better than 48. 384 is better than 48.
Sure, but if you sum it up, they have do they have the same performance? I guess so. Right. So the total performance should be the same, right? No. So
what we have seen is that if you have more gigaflops, that's much better, yes, because you can
No. Did I mess it up? Yeah. So you even have more power on the second system, right? So here you only have Of course, you have more power on the first one,
no,
right?
On the second one, you switch to 8 and 4.
But if you have
but very similar.
Very similar, no.
But if you have less CPUs, it's better, no? Because the heating factor will be less.
Sure, that's another factor, right? If so you could assume that each of those CPUs take less power because they just do less, right? That's of course a factor, obviously.
But in the second variant, no? So in the second variant, okay, in the second variant you're using more of the CPUs, but are 10 times less, almost 10 times less than the first one.
Sure.
So the heating factor will be that you won't have so much heating in the second variant, or?
On the contrary.
So
let's assume that they are built with a similar technology, okay, and let's assume that variant two just has a higher clock frequency, okay, just for the sake of it, okay. Higher clock frequency means that the chip gets hotter, right? That means that you have to cool it much more, okay. So if you take, so let's assume that they also have the same die space, okay. So 1 and 2, right? So the two, the CPU two will get much hotter than CPU one, right? That's the assumption, okay. Even though you have to cool less on the variant one, right? You have to transport the heat, so you have to transport way more heat out of this variant 2 CPU than out of this variant 1 CPU, right? That means that you have to have way more sophisticated cooling system here than you have here. So variant 1 might be able to be cooled by air, but variant 2 maybe not so much, right? Because you have to dissipate so much heat, right? So the cooling system for variant 1 will definitely, would probably be definitely less complicated than for variant 2.
But I think that I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, and that a cooling system, it's much cheaper than a CPU. CPU is more expensive.
Sure, but you might also get a better yield with those lower CPUs, right?
You get a better what?
A better yield in the manufacturing process. That means that each time you manufacture such a CPU, it might actually cost you less than with the more complicated CPU, right? So that means that in turn, the manufacturing costs might be much higher for the variant 2 as well, right?
No, there's no definite answer.
There's no definite answer, no. And The intuitive answer, of course, is that variant 2 is better, right? However, if you consider this picture again, right, where we could just increase the problem size, right, then variant 1 eventually gets way more approachable, right?
Because you have more caches nearby. Because if you have a bigger size,
the communication cost for the variant 2 is probably lower than the communication cost for variant 1, right? Unless you have a very, very high performance network, right? So the parallelizable portion of the code is always the same, right? As well as the serial fraction of the code, right? So at first, of course, the variant 2 is definitely faster, right? Unless you can scale up way more with variant 1, right? So increase the problem size, right, and get more out of it. Okay. So that's the approach, right? So let's look again at the processor architecture of the BlueJean system. So what's very interesting is that the BlueJean processor is based on The design is based on this PowerPC 440, okay, which is a processor that's been used for embedded devices. Okay, so one interesting side remark is that the PowerPC processors, so those embedded processors, are certified to be operated in things like helicopters and such, right? Even for military purposes. And they just took this processor design and extended it, right? So essentially what you need in order to support the scientific computing need is, well, you need some floating point units, right? And you need some floating point units, and of course you need to have some support for the network. Okay, so the complete ASIC, so ASIC here stands for application-specific integrated circuit. Okay, so again, the entire chip was built for the BlueJean systems. However, in contrast to the Earth simulator, BlueJean systems were built all around the world. We also had one in Germany, or still, no, we had one in Germany. It's being decommissioned at the moment. Okay, and so you have two CPU cores on the chip, right? Each have their own level one cache, the additional floating point unit, and then you have the level two cache with a snooping protocol in between the cores. And from the caches, you can directly go onto the network. Okay, so that's a pretty unique feature for the BlueJean designs, that the network communication actually happens through the caches, right? You don't have to go through main memory necessarily. So the networks can directly inject into the caches. Okay, and now to answer the question, which network they have. So what you see here is that you have one Ethernet connection, one Taurus connection, one tree connection, and one connection for global interrupts. Okay, so you actually had four networks in the BlueJean systems. Okay, and of course some main memory. So at the end you have the shared level three directory for the L2 caches. Okay, and the level three cache is connected to a embedded DRAM chip, so four megabytes of embedded DRAM, which can be used as cache or memory. And from this directory, you also have the memory controller, which is able to talk to DDR memory. Okay, so the reason why they have different networks, obviously, is that in order to support different applications, right? So Taurus network for those neighborhood communication problems, the tree network for global communication, and the global interrupt to implement barriers and such, right? So. So the level three cache is implemented as embedded DRAM, which is kind of interesting because the more traditional approach to implement cache is actually via SRAM, okay? And the trade-off here is that SRAM is a little bit faster than DRAM. But eDRAM is way more space efficient, okay? That means that you can pack in way more cache with the eDRAM technology, and actually IBM, I think, is still holding on to it, and I think they are the only ones who are building embedded DRAM onto their chips to implement the caches. Okay, and it's also a challenge for the actual manufacturing process, right? But IBM still builds the chip in such ways. So the Power9 chip, for example, also still has the embedded DRAM. Okay. So the other important factor when designing the system was that you really should have reliable components. Okay, and since it's based on the embedded chip, where they had lots of experience in terms of reliability and fault tolerance, etc. The BlueJean chips essentially inherited that from the embedded PowerPC design. Okay, and so all caches are ECC protected. Only the level one cache has a parity bit. And the network is also protected by the CRC checksum. Okay, so the emphasis really was to develop a very high reliable and fault tolerant system. Okay, and so one of the reasons why they were able to achieve that is obviously because they it's fairly low. It has a fairly low frequency, right? So the less frequency, the less space for error there is, right? And as mentioned, the probability, so the yield of the actual manufacturing is also increased when having the chip operated at lower frequencies. Okay, so again, the overview of the network architecture. So the torus is built as a three-dimensional torus, which is good for the point-to-point communications, for the neighborhood point-to-point communications. Then you had the global tree network, right, which is which should be used for the global operations. Okay, and in addition to that, you have the another tree network for the global barriers and interrupts for the, of the system. So you could easily implement low latency barriers and interrupts. And the gigabit Ethernet is for file I/O and more basically to just connect to the compute nodes via SSH or something. In addition to that, you have an additional control network, which was used to monitor the system, to diagnose potential problems, and to actually boot the different nodes. Okay, so if you logged on to such a system and requested a allocation for some amount of compute nodes, those compute nodes were specially booted just for you, okay, via the control network. So it took quite some time to actually get to a running application. Okay. All right. So the 3D network has, of course, the highest aggregated bandwidth, right? Because each link has is essentially their own router. So you can get the highest bandwidth in terms of when you only do neighborhood communication. The problem here, however, is that you may require multiple hops if you communicate from with processes far apart, right? And this leads to non-uniform network latency, and it's really fastest only for direct neighborhood communication. To overcome this problem, you have the additional tree network where you have better scalability for the collective operations, okay? And collective operations are important for scientific applications. For example, if you take your iterative solver, right, which tries to solve your partial differential equation, in order to know that you reach the solution, you always have to check the residual, for example, and that's essentially a global global reduction, right? All right. So the networks are, in addition to that, split into electronically separate aisles, and this means that you have better fault tolerance, so you could easily switch off some parts and replace them and isolate them from the rest of the system, right? So you, so if one node goes down, you don't lose the entire machine, you only lose probably the compute card the nodes on. Okay, so so much for the BlueJean system. Okay. The next top one system is actually the IBM Roadrunner, so another IBM system. This one now is the fastest from November 2008, so 10 years ago. It was surpassed by the Czechia system only a year after that. And it has, well, between 19,000 and 130,000 cores at about 3.2 gigahertz. But as we see, it's not that easy to actually count the number of cores and then the clock frequency, okay? But the interesting thing is, it's the first machine that actually reached the petaflops, okay? And it's mostly off-the-shelf hardware, but in a kind of unusual combination. And it's also the first hybrid or heterogeneous supercomputer. Okay, and this one is located at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Okay, and here's a picture of it. It doesn't look very fancy, does it?
Why it says between 109,000 and 1 million?
Okay. Let's see.
Okay. So why it says that?
Let's see. So the system is built out of two plates. So each node is, two plates, one LS21 and one QS22 plate. Okay. And the LS21 has two Opteron CPUs, two Opteron chips. So each Opteron chip has two cores, so four cores. It's operated at 1.8 gigahertz. And in addition to that, you have the QS22 with two PowerX cell processors operated at 3.2 gigahertz. Okay. And so the configuration is that you had one of those LS21 and two of those QS22 blades. So they form a triblade. And three of those triblades are placed in a blade sender unit, and the blade senders and four of those blade senders are placed in a rack. Okay. So do you still remember the cell processor? No? PlayStation 3? Yeah? Okay.
I remember that someone built a pretty powerful computer just by networking PlayStation, basically, yeah.
Yeah. So this is the first point, right? You have one Opteron CPU, which is essentially a x86 CPU built from AMD, and then you have the PowerXL CPUs, which are IBM processors. Okay, so that's the first point, right? So which do you count, right? Which frequency and what do you count, right? So here's again an overview of the system, right? You have your triblade. You have your blade sender, your rack, and then you have five racks which form a connected unit, and so on and so forth, right? 15 racks form a connected unit, and then the Roadrunner had 18 connected units. We'll see later what this connected units is all about. Okay. So to address the question, which cores to count, okay? Do we count the Opterons, or here on the slide is cells, SPEs, PPUs, okay? So what do we count? So let's look at it a little deeper. So we had one AMD Opteron, which is a standard dual core chip. Right, and then we have the IBM PowerXL 8i, right, and it's an advanced version of the IBM cell processor. Okay, and the advancement is that it has a higher double precision performance than what has been built into the PlayStations. Okay. Right. So the Opterons are connected via hypertransport. Right. Then you had your InfiniBand, which is also connected over the hypertransport is here. Then you have the InfiniBand, which is also connected over the hypertransport layer, and the cell processors are also connected via this hypertransport link. So they are connected via this extension board, which also holds the InfiniBand hardware, right? And here you slightly see what the cell is built up. So each cell has one PPU, which stands for power processing unit, and one SPE, which stands for I always forget. It's special purpose execution. So it's the special execution unit on the system. So you had a dual core normal CPU and those special purpose cores built into one chip, right? So again, which cores to count, right? So it's a heterogeneous system on multiple levels. You have x86 cores here, you have power cores here, and special different cores next to the power cores, right? And what's interesting is that the streaming performance of the system is quite interesting. For the Opteron processors, you get 5 gigabytes per second of bandwidth. For the power processor on the cell chip, you get 0.89 gigabytes per second. And for the SPEs, you get almost 30 gigabytes per second, right? So the SPEs are really the workhorse for the scientific applications here. Okay. So the idea is that many computing tasks can and should be distributed on lots of CPUs to increase the overall memory performance, right? And usual CPUs use homogeneous cores on the CPUs. That means that on a single chip, even if you have multiple cores, you have the same architecture for each core, right? And if you have a homogeneous supercomputer, then every core that's in the system is the same architecture, right? So if you have the classic SMP, so simultaneous multi-processor computers, you have different processor nodes and all with approximately the same access time to main memory, right? And the cell goes into a different direction and it follows a different approach where we have different processor architectures on one chip for executing specific tasks. Okay, so the cell is a processor design, but also, well, a programming paradigm. Okay, and according to IBM, it's a revolutionary new processor design where you have one processing unit and up to 8 independent SIMD vector processors. Okay, you have on those vector processors, you don't have on-chip caches, so none at all. Okay, so you have to essentially write some software caching, and the idea is really to allow for massively parallel computing, right? So to have small independent tasks which run on the different SIMD processors. Because you don't need cache logic then. So very similar to GPU programming, right? You have your cores which are able to execute lots of operations in parallel in one clock cycle, right? And the question is, how do you feed the required data to the processor, right? How do you keep them busy to not stall that much, right? And the answer at that time was, well, yeah, we provide a local scratchpad, right, where the programmer should place the data that's needed. The placement of the data can be done completely asynchronously. Okay, so you could put the data that you need in the near future to this local scratchpad, right, while computing at the same time. Okay, so that way you could, the idea is to completely hide the latencies of the memory transfers, right, and to not rely on some sophisticated cache logic, because usually the programmer knows best, right? So, but we'll see how this works out in practice, right? So, short history of the cell development. So it was a joint venture between Sony, Toshiba, and IBM. Okay, and in 2002 and 2004, the patent was issued. It became the CPU for the PlayStation 3, right? IBM started production in the first half year of 2005, and the first server and workstations from IBM were delivered at the end of 2005, and it's also used in HD TV systems of Sony and Toshiba since 2006, right? And as you mentioned, some people build huge clusters with the PlayStation 3. Very much so. A PlayStation 3 was much cheaper than any of those PowerXL chips, right? Even though not as high performant, and they had some cores turned off, but still, a PlayStation 3 I think cost around 300 euros or something like that, right? Compare that to a few thousand euros, right, for one single rack with a PowerXL, right? The main reason why the PlayStation 3 was so much cheaper is because they each console is subsidized with the games they sell on the console, right? So the actual hardware has to be cheap. So you have your entry level investment for the game has to be very low, right? So the you can attract to your system, and then you make money out of the games that you sell for the system. Okay. That's the short history. So the chip in the layout is looks something like this, right? You have your memory controller over at the bottom. You have your I/O controller, at the top, and your I/O controller at the bottom. Then you have your power processor element, right? You have your cache for the power processor, right? You see, it's almost the same size, right? And then you have your SPE units, right? And in between those, you have the element interconnect bus, right? And you see, if you would build a cache into the SPEs, right, then you would run out of space quite easily. So the overview is a little like this. You have your power processor element, right, which is a power architecture based architecture. They have their own level one cache and the level two cache, which is connected to the element interconnect bus, right? The element interconnect bus is connected to the memory interface controller, which then connects to the to main memory, and the element interconnect bus also has the SPE units attached to it. Okay, so more detailed, you have your power processing element, right? You have the power core with the two-level cache hierarchy. Then you have this element interconnect bus, which connects all the systems, right? And then for the SPEs, you have one DMA controller, which stands for direct memory access, which is able to directly speak to the memory controller, so you don't have to go to the power processing unit. You have your local scratchpad, right, where you can store the data that's coming out of the DMA. And then you have your execution unit at the top. Right. So the PowerPC, PowerPC processor element has two-way simultaneous multithreading. So it really only had one core, but two hardware threads. It had still special vector units in the power. In PowerSpeak, they are called Altivec. Okay, or VMX. For x86, it's SSE or AVX. For ARM, it's Neon. It's a complete in-order design, and you have the SPEs, synergistic processing elements, okay, where you have eight of them in one chip. Right? The element interface bus, not interconnect, interface bus, consists of 4 × 16-byte large data rings, right? And that means that the bandwidth you get through the element interconnect bus is 96 bytes per cycle. Okay. You also have a dual-channel memory interface where you can get 12.8 gigabytes per second per channel. And your dual-channel bus interface controller where you get 76.8 gigabytes per second. Okay, so, right, the power processor element is not so interesting, I think. It's, well, very similar to what we saw earlier with the x86, right? You have your instruction decoding happening over here with the branch prediction, with the instruction fetch unit, the instruction cache. You have your two hardware threads here, and then the dispatch queue, which then puts it off to the actual execution units, where you have another decode, dependency scanning, and issue phase. And then you have your scalar unit and your vector unit on the CPU, very much the same as we saw with the other CPU-based designs. The SPE, well, the vector or SIMD processor, is very much different there, right? You have your on-chip coherent bus and the DMA unit, which you have to use, so which you have to explicitly program in order to get data from main memory, right? And the DMA unit reads and writes to the local store, right? You have 256 kilobytes of local storage. And the instruction decoder reads from the local store, right? The next instruction. It has a fairly large register file with result forwarding and staging. You have your floating point unit and your fixed point unit. And of course, also branching, load store and permutation, and so on and so forth, right? So that's quite different and way more simple than what you had with your regular generic CPU, right? And yeah, and you don't have a cache. A cache.
Why the cache?
Hmm?
Why the cache?
You don't have a cache.
I don't have.
Yeah. But the nice thing here is that you can read 128 bytes per cycle from the local store, right? Which is then again quite fast. Right. So the other thing is that the SPEs are no co-processors in the sense that you just dispatch instructions to them. They are more like independent units which execute their own programs. The programs are loaded in the local SPE memory from your power processor unit. Each SPE contains an SPU and an SXU, so the SPE execution unit, right? And they operate on 128 bit vectors. That means that you they are set up in such a way that they can hold 4 32-bit elements, right? And you have the direct memory access via the DMA controller to get the data in and out, right? And it runs simultaneously, so it runs in parallel to the actual execution unit. So again, this is just the summary, and this is how you would program that beast, right? So This is a simple C program, more or less. You include the various headers, right? So this is the main program running on the power processor. Okay, you need some program handle. Here we just set the number of SPU threads, right? And we have the PPU thread function. That's the pthread entry point, which is then used to dispatch or to run the specific code on the SPE, right? So we first set up the context, right? The context is passed in via the void argument, and we then just run the context with the default entry point, right? And once that's completed, we just exit the thread, right? In the main function, we set the number of SPU threads, we set the number of contexts, and then we also have a structure to hold the different P threads that we created. We then get the available number of SPE threads that are usable. So how many SPE cores we actually have in the system, right? So as I mentioned, the PlayStation has a fewer core count than the Power Excel. So you don't necessarily you can't necessarily rely on the fact that you always have 8. But you could also have 7, right? And yeah, so you just some simple check. Then you loop over the number of threads that you have, create the context, load the program, and then create the thread, which then drives the SPU, and you wait until all threads have been completed, right? So now compare that to how you actually offload programs to a CUDA device, right? So quite some improvement there, I think. And the SPE program is then fairly simple. So it's a normal or regular C program. So the SPEs support C and C++, no big deal there. And you have your regular main function, which serves as the entry point, and you can, of course, do printfs or regular I/O on the SPEs as well, right? So that's it. Right? Quite some effort to get something running on the SPEs. And what we didn't handle yet is how you transfer memory, how you transfer data to the SPEs, right? So the SPEs for themselves here are completely isolated. They can only operate on the local store or issue DMA transfers. Okay, so the network architecture, as mentioned, is done via the control units. So you had your connected units, and each connected unit is then connected to the voltage switches, right? So you had 8 switches here, and the switches themselves are interconnected with each other, and each control unit is connected. Each control unit is connected to each switch, right? And in total, it would have allowed for up to 24 control units, right? And the Voltaire switches are essentially a full crossbar switch, right? But with this layered design here, you don't have a fully connected topology, but you have this switching layer in between. Right. So for that reason, you had different number of hops for the different when accessing the different nodes, right? So if you stay within the within your own node, obviously you don't need any hop onto the switches at all. If you stay within the same crossbar, you need one hop, right? Within the same connected unit, you need three hops, right? If you are on the same crossbar with the connected units, you also need three hops. If you are on a different crossbar, you need two additional hops, and so on and so forth, right? So it's non-uniform memory, non-uniform latency in the networking part. However, you have a upper bound in terms of latency, and the average then can be taken as 5.38 hops on average. The bandwidth, what do I want to say there? Sorry. So the bandwidth here is pretty constant. If you talk within a node to the different cores, right? So you have different different access latencies. So opteron to cell is 3.2 microseconds. If you are completely local, you have 0.12 microseconds. If you want to if you want to communicate from opteron to opteron via MPI or via InfiniBand, you are at 2.16 microseconds. So that's a pretty low latency that you have here. Okay. So one thing I wanted to mention for the cell processors is I think so the Roadrunner wasn't a huge success, right? Because it was very, very hard to program in. So the whole infrastructure to get code running efficiently on the Roadrunner or the cell in particular wasn't very good. So you had to do lots of hand tuning and write lots of code in order to get those data transfers efficiently, right? But the overall programmer, especially in the scientific computing community, weren't very happy with the design because it required lots of coding efforts and lots of engineering effort to get efficient code there, right? So you might still find some articles on the internet from game developers who weren't very happy with the design either, right? But then on the other hand, the PlayStation 3 had some very nice games, I think, right? And I'm not even sure if they even had dedicated graphics hardware, but I might be wrong there. No? Anyways, it's quite an impressive system, even though it wasn't a huge success by itself. I think it laid the path towards more heterogeneous architectures. Okay, such that we see today, right, with the graphics cards. And the main difference here, I believe, is that the CUDA programming environment is just way, way more simpler to actually get some code running and get good results on the hardware there. Even though it's still fairly complicated, it's a significant improvement over what has been done with the cell design, okay. But I think NVIDIA learned quite a lot from the cell experience there. Okay, so should we call it a day, or should we go over the next one as well? It's almost holidays after all, right?
Exactly.
All right. Yeah.